When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome into another edition of the Nick Bob Podcast, coming to you live from the AOI Studios. If you're looking for the absolute best in office furniture, like this great table I've got right in front of me right here for my pod room, or some new chairs like the Aeron chair from Herman Miller that I'm currently sitting in, you got to check out AOI. The Aeron chair from Herman Miller is based on the latest research around the science of sitting, advancements in materials, manufacturing, and technology. I love this chair. Check out AOI on the web, AOIcorp.com. That's AOIcorp.com, or give them a call, 402-896-5520. That's 896-5520. It is Thursday night, February 6th, and we got a heck of a podcast on deck for you. John Niatawa is going to stop by in a little bit. Creighton beat writer for the Omaha World Herald. Obviously, the Blue Jays had a great win at Villanova over the weekend and got back into the top 25, and then had a stinker of a second half at Providence and lost on the road to the Friars. So there's a lot to discuss with that game and the Creighton season as March is getting closer and closer and closer. But before I bring on John, I've gotten a few tweets and emails about this new Big Ten transfer rule proposal, and people kind of wondering what my thoughts are on it, because, you know, I'm someone that's transferred. I'm very much involved in the college athletics world with what I do with college basketball. So I've gotten some people say, hey, what do you think of this? So if you missed it, there was a report that the Big Ten conference athletic directors are almost all on board with a new transfer proposal that would allow every college athlete to transfer once without any penalty of having to sit out a year. So basically, every single college athlete, college basketball players, college football players, they can now transfer one time and play right away. Now, the soonest this legislation could go into effect would be 2021, but man, that's a sizable change from the old rule of if you transfer, you have to sit out a year, which was always a pretty sizable deterrent for kids transferring. I mean, I transferred from Kansas to Creighton, so I can speak to this. And listen, when I was sitting in the Jayhawk Towers kicking around the decision in Lawrence, Kansas to potentially transfer, one of the biggest factors that I had to weigh was sitting out a year. Nobody wants to do that, right? Like, nobody wants to just sit out a season. And I think that is something that weighs on a lot of kids' decisions. Like, I think there's a lot of players out there that think about transferring that ultimately don't transfer because they're like, man, I don't want to sit out a year. And the other part of the whole having to sit out a year, that also weighs on the coach's decision to take transfers too. Because think about it. If a coach takes a transfer, take Marcus Foster, for example, who left Kansas State and transferred to Creighton. Creighton had Marcus Foster on scholarship for the year that he sat out. So you are using a scholarship for 3 years and only getting 2 years of eligibility out of Marcus Foster. Like, when you only have 13 scholarships, that's a big deal. And I know in football you got bigger numbers, so it's not as impactful, but nevertheless, like, you don't want to be in the business of tying up scholarships for guys that you know cannot get on the field or the court and make an impact. So that makes it so the coaches have to weigh that too. Okay, how bad do I want Marcus Foster? You know, how bad do I want Delano Banton? How bad do I want Shamil Stevenson? You know, how bad do I want Grant Gibbs? You're like, you have to think about all those things. How bad do I want big old Darian Daniels? If you got to think about those things. So the whole sitting out thing when transferring was a big deal, not only for the players, but also the coaches making an investment into the kid too. So what do I think on this proposal that every athlete can transfer once without having to sit out? Okay, let's kind of unpack this whole thing because there's a lot in it, man. And there are elements I like and there are elements that I am terrified of and don't like. I'll start. What I like about it is it greatly simplifies the whole transfer situation and provides some much needed uniformity. Because, and I don't know how we've gotten here, but all of a sudden, the whole transfer rule has morphed into something that lacks any consistency. Relatively speaking, it wasn't that long ago that I transferred. I sat out the 2005-2006 season. So, I mean, that's not that long ago. The thought of like applying for a waiver and being able to be eligible, I mean, that wasn't even like a thought. Now, shit, everybody that transfers applies for a waiver. You're like, hey, what the hell? And who gets granted a waiver to be eligible immediately and who doesn't is silly, and there is seemingly no rhyme or reason to it at all. You can have two very similar situations. Take Antoine Jones, the Memphis transfer who has to sit out for Creighton right now. There are some of Antoine Jones's teammates who transferred from Memphis who are eligible and playing right now, but Jones isn't. You know, like there's no rhyme or reason to it. Quentin Grimes at Kansas left KU and is eligible immediately at Houston. How? I have no idea. You know, I mean, we all saw it with Noah Vedral. God, no, I love Noah Vedral. And, you know, listen, there are most times like, you want to see things kind of shake out for the kids, but like why Noah Vedral was granted a waiver to be eligible immediately is beyond me. And why it took so long for it to go through. It's just, so I think this is something that has everyone really frustrated. Like the lack of uniformity, there's no consistency, there seems to be no rhyme or reason at all to who's getting a waiver, who's not, and then there's no timetable for it too. I mean, Fred Hoiberg was kind of held hostage seemingly for all of the preseason, hell, even into the season on what was going to happen with Shamil Stevenson, who was a transfer who was at Pitt and then Nevada and then now at Nebraska. They'd applied for a waiver, and you're just kind of like sitting there like twiddling your thumbs like, is it going to happen? I don't know. I have no idea when this decision is going to be made and, you know, really what's going to go into it. So at least this new proposal, giving everyone one free transfer, for lack of a better term, clears things up, right? Makes it simple, makes it clean, provides some consistency to it. So I do like that because I hate this nonsensical, inconsistent world we are living in now where for no rhyme or reason, certain guys can transfer and play right away and others can't. So I like that. It's probably the thing I like about it the most is it cleans up something that is really messy right now. And, you know, the reality is this. It can be hard to justify that players have to sit out if they change schools, but coaches can go coach somewhere else right away. And I know that's something you just go like, well, that's how it's always been. It's like, well, hold on, let's all just take a deep breath and step back and like think about that. You know, as the years go on and the more, you know, everybody becomes, you know, thinks about things more, that kind of feels like it gets harder and harder to justify. Like, why should Scott Frost be able to leave Central Florida and coach at Nebraska right away, but Noah Vedral can't? So it's hard. And you know what? This is kind of where things are headed. The pendulum of power is kind of swinging to the players to even things out for them to have a little more power with things, right? Like it feels like there's an inevitability of college athletes being able to get paid off their name, image, and likeness. Like things are changing. And I always think it's better to get ahead of things and get progressive and get proactive rather than reactive. And again, it's always messy each year now. Like, the transfer portal's crazy, right? And then who gets waivers and who doesn't? And, you know, then you even have the messy situations of, you know, the coaches blocking players of where they can transfer to and where they can't. And then that plays out publicly, and it's ugly, right? I just think times are a-changing, and you can kick and scream all you want, but it is what it is. And along those lines, I think college basketball is in an interesting place, more so than college football. But college basketball and the NCAA, it kind of feels like it's under siege, doesn't it? And with certain top prospects choosing not to come play college basketball, and all the one and dones and players leaving early, and like, I don't care what anyone says, that's all not good. Because it gives off this perception that college basketball is not a place anyone wants to be. And that's a shame, because college basketball is great and does so many great things. But the perception of college basketball and the NCAA is pretty low right now. And I think it would behoove the NCAA and college basketball to be more inclusive than exclusive. I think college basketball needs to do all it can to make it so it's a place where elite players want to be. And if this transfer rule helps that, then I think it's worth exploring. But with all that said, and I do hate it when people fearmonger and paint worst case scenario for things, but boy, is this a slippery slope to go down. Boy, if this ain't Pandora's box, I don't know what is. Because let's face it, allowing a one-time transfer with not having to sit out, you are basically creating free agency in college basketball and college football. Like I said at the top, that 1 year of having to sit out is a huge deterrent for everyone. Coaches have to commit multiple years of a scholarship for fewer years of that player being able to actually be on the court or field, and players have to willingly sit out for a full year, which is not fun. And, you know, the year of sitting out forces coaches to really have to plan things out. Like, think about it. If you could be eligible right away, like if this rule, like if you transfer and you're eligible right away, one-time transfer eligible right away, anytime a need pops up for a coach, well, boom, you can go fill it right then and there. It's different now when the majority of needs that pop up with your roster, the only way to fill it is with a graduate transfer. And I'm sure you've noticed, oftentimes the most coveted transfers each year in football and basketball are the grad transfers. Why? Because they can play right away. Well, we'd now be living in a world where the transfer portal would be pretty much chock full of players that can come play for you immediately. Oh boy. And listen, I'm someone who transferred, so I get how this can look or sound coming from me. But at the same time, I also feel like I'm uniquely qualified to talk about this. But I fear passing this rule would make it so basically very few kids would be patient and work and stick around and fight through frustration to get playing time. I fear that the days of Divine Ozigbo are gone. The whole wait your turn, be patient, work, develop, grow, that could be hard. I think a lot of kids would bail pretty quick if things didn't go well for them at school. out of school right away. I mean, hell, that's happening already, which makes player development really hard for a program. And the biggest thing, and this is really big in college basketball, finding continuity with your roster could be extremely difficult if this rule goes through. I mean, it's already tough in college basketball. With all the one and dones and players leaving early and transfers now, continuity has taken a big hit, which I think hurts the overall quality of the teams and sport as a whole. And I think it impacts the fans' experience. Like each year, a lot of teams are completely different. And that's hard on everyone. It's hard on the fans. It's hard on the coaches. I'm not so sure. And I may have to walk this one back. But I'm not so sure that this new rule proposal, allowing players to transfer once and be eligible right away, I think that rule could impact college football and college basketball more than allowing players to profit off name, image, and likeness. I know that sounds crazy. I'm not so sure that the one free transfer wouldn't impact the landscape of college athletics more. Because again, I think when push comes to shove, the amount of kids that actually would garner a lot of money in the open market for their name, image, and likeness are fairly, I don't think it's as big as, I think we paint this picture like, yeah, everybody's going to be getting like $500,000 endorsement deals. And it's like, listen, these business people are not in their, they've built a business because they're usually pretty sound with their money. They're not going to be just like, yeah, this left tackle who may or may not be good. Yeah, here's $500,000. Eh, that ain't happen. Here's $100,000 for that wide receiver. Oh, who is that? That's a shooting guard. Yeah, give him 50 G's. I don't know. But I think I'm not so sure that allowing players to transfer right away and be eligible right away wouldn't have a bigger impact on the sport. And, you know, listen, people love to paint, and I'm doing it a little bit too. Like, I mean, people love to paint a doomsday scenario for these sorts of things. But I'm not so sure that in the doomsday scenario that you conjure up in your mind, allowing kids to transfer once without sitting out feels like it would be a pretty hectic world. Who knows? Again, just like anything, there would be a spike, and then things would normalize. Right? Like, I bet, you know, when the name, image, and likeness thing goes through, I bet maybe the first couple of years, yeah, you might see people being a little reckless with their money, but then things are going to tighten up. Maybe it'd be the same thing with this one free transfer. Maybe the first couple of years of it would be a mass exodus at the end of every season for it'd just be like musical chairs and people just changing different, it'd be crazy, and then it would normalize. But again, this rule is one free transfer, just one. So it's not like you can go from, you know, my freshman year, I'm going to go to Syracuse, and now I'm going to go to Mississippi State. I didn't like that. I'm going to go to Ohio State. And no, it's you get one free transfer to be eligible right away. So, you know, I see a lot of sides to this thing. The devil is always in the details. And how this proposed rule would get it, you know, what the language in it would be, how it would get administered and applied with regards to specifics would be very interesting. I like how it simplifies the transfer process, which is becoming a huge deal in college sports. But while simplifying the transfer process itself, you would be making the entire sport potentially more chaotic. And so that's kind of how I see it. I know the thing to do nowadays is to always have a strong hot take on one side of an issue, but I don't know. I don't have to operate in the daily talking head world, so I can kind of live in the real world where nuance and gray area exists, you know? And And, you know, you can, oh, I don't know, see both sides of an issue and stay level-headed about discussing things with it. Like, that's where I'm going to be with it. So there you go. It's going to be fascinating to see what happens with this potential rule proposal. One that I think could potentially have, you know, pretty sizable ramifications on the landscape of college basketball and college football. All right, let's get to the guest of the day. John Niatawa, Creighton beat writer, Omaha World Herald. Great guy, does a great job. Always enjoy reading his stuff, and I always enjoy talking hoops with him. I love it when I see him at the games and I get to, you know, have our little five-minute chats before the game or whatever. He's just a great guy. He's got a great mind. John was on the pod right before Denzel Mahoney was eligible, so almost 2 months ago. So a lot has happened with Creighton during that time. So we have certainly a lot to talk about, so let's get to it. Here is my podcast chat with John Niatawa. Well, we touched base with this guy. Gosh, this would have been right at the beginning of December, I think, right as Denzel Mahoney was going to become eligible. We had a lot to talk about. He's John Niatawa. He's the Creighton basketball beat writer, the Creighton beat writer for the Omaha World Herald. John, how are things?
Nick, they're pretty good, man. Obviously, it's basketball season, so I can't complain.
Right.
And some news in the Niatawa household 2 weeks ago. Our son was born, Simon. So we are in full newborn baby mode.
Okay, because I wrote down baby question mark because I had heard some rumblings.
Right.
I don't even think I, and maybe shame on me, I don't even think I knew, I didn't even know that a baby was on the way.
Yeah. But, it's that weird thing, Nick. Like, I have really backed away from, like, the social media, like, the personal aspects of social media. I feel like it's just gotten kind of dark, and so I've treated it like, you know, hey, here's my links to my stories if you want to read them. Bye. So if I had gotten a personal, like a really deep conversation with someone, then I kind of unveiled it, but I don't know. I think just naturally I'm kind of more of a private person. So I really wasn't broadcasting it. So a lot of people said that to me.
I was going to ask
you about
that.
I need to do a better job. Maybe I need to get some t-shirts or something. I don't know. But,
I agree. It's always this weird thing on how much you want to divulge about your personal life when you kind of become a quote unquote public figure with what you and I both do. We're in the media, you know, there's a balance, right? You kind of want to humanize yourself and let people in, but there's, I don't know, man, like there are sometimes, you know, there'll be times I'll post pictures of my daughter Mava. And then I'll like, there are moments I'm like, should I be like, how much should I be doing this? You know, like there's a weird balance there.
Right. I'll tell you what though, since my son's been on this earth, like I haven't gone to Twitter or Instagram or Facebook yet. But I've wanted to more than ever. So I'm like, there's so much pride and joy that you have watching him just like be a human. And I'm like, I want to share this with everyone. I don't even care if they care.
Yeah.
So I don't know. We'll see. Simon may make his Twitter appearance soon. But you're right, though. It's like trying to find that balance. Yeah. A lot of times I'm just like, my role as a journalist is to tell the story of the people I cover and not necessarily tell my own story. So I try to, I don't know. I think I err more on the side of like,
I think it's smart.
I'll back away.
Yeah. I've tried to, and I don't know if this is smart or not, but I've really pulled back from, you know, getting into it with people on Twitter. You know what I mean? Like engaging on, mm-hmm. you know, like I finally asked myself, like, this was probably like a year and a half, 2 years ago. I'm like, I don't think I've ever gotten into it with anyone on Twitter and felt better about anything, about myself, about anything after the fact. So like, I'm with you. Like there are times I revert and I'll kind of like go back to where I'm divulging too much, or I'll get into it with someone. But I've started to pull back a little bit as well.
I try to give people a response as much as I can, especially if they're asking questions. And so I try to get back to them as best I can, but you're right. I'm not voting in the AP poll this year, but I was an AP voter the last 3 years. And I'll tell you what, I got a little bit too invested going back and forth with people about who I was voting for and who I wasn't. Right. I remember I was visiting my family in Indianapolis my sister, she has two nieces now, three, but two at the time. I'm sorry, she has two kids now, three. They're my nieces.
Yes.
You know how it goes.
Yes.
So I was hanging out with them while also like pulling my phone out of my pocket. I think we might have been playing like Phase 10 or something, and some card game. And I'm like, hold on 1 second before I lay down my hand. Let me just respond to this dude in Michigan who's upset that I don't have the Wolverines ranked in the top 25. Right. So I was like, at some point, you do need to just check out because you'll spend so much time on there. It's pointless, really. Yes. I mean, I guess it's not pointless because there usually, I mean, I feel like there's reasonable people on the other end that want to hear from you, but if you're just kind of going around in circles, then it becomes pointless. So you got to kind of recognize that.
Yeah, I've tried to, and this is, you know, I certainly see the negative comments, but I only try to acknowledge the positive one. Like if someone, you know, were to, hey, Nick, great job on the Seton Hall game. I try to respond to that, you know, like, and it's not to say I'm trying to like create a world, like a fairy tale world where like, I only know that, I mean, I see the negative stuff, but it's like, if someone says, hey, you suck. I don't know. Like I see it. Like I don't really want to engage in that. And I've even had to, and it can be challenging. I've tried to make a rule with myself that like I don't check Twitter during a game that I'm calling. Mm-hmm. You know, I might have told you this, but like because what the worst thing you do is someone, you know, it's the under 16 media timeout. You check Twitter. You know, a Providence fan or just, you know, is like, man, but I can't believe how big of a homer this guy is. And so then you all of a sudden you're in your head, you're like, okay, I need to go out of my way to praise, yeah, you know, Malik White for this or that, you know, and then you're not just like saying what you see. And then it's a weird slope you're going down.
Yeah. And the thing about Twitter is sometimes it can be an echo chamber. And a lot of times it's not representative of your whole audience. So
yeah,
you're getting kind of a different view on it. But
yep.
Yeah, I mean, it's fun. It's a fun place to be, but it's also, it can be distracting and not exactly constructive. So I don't know. I might go dive back in. There was a while there, you know, 5 years ago where I was like on it all the time and interacting with people and sharing parts of my life with the folks on Twitter and same with Instagram. So maybe, and Snapchat too, but I dialed it all back.
I hear you, man. Since you got to get back to Simon here at some point, the little guy, I won't keep you too long here because you and I were joking before we came on. Like our last conversation, did it last 2 hours? Like, I mean, we almost. almost went 2 hours on Creighton basketball. So we got.
I think my phone like died.
No, right. I got an alert that said, "Really?"
As soon as I hung up, it was done.
Yeah, I was like, "I'm done, man. I need to go hit the ice bath here after this." But so we won't we won't go too long here. But let's talk a little Creighton hoops here, John. So we're taping this it's about 6:30 on Thursday, February 6th. So yesterday, Creighton lost on the road at Providence, and let's start there. I mean, like, I think. And when I say you, I mean, I'm talking you, meaning like everyone. You can't ride the wave too much. You can't, after the Villanova game, it can't be, oh, this Creighton team's amazing. Sweet 16 is happening this year. And then after the Providence loss, it can't be, this team stinks. There's no way they're making a run. Like, I just don't think like both ends of the spectrum are probably equally like too much. The reality is with that game, like that's probably the best Providence has shot the ball. And that's probably the worst Creighton has shot the ball. And when that's the case, it's not hard to connect the dots as to what really happened. I guess, how do you balance, like, really, because every game matters, but you also don't want to overreact to it. I guess, how did you kind of make heads or tails of the Providence loss?
Yeah, I think you're right in that when one team has one of its worst shooting performances, another team has one of its best, generally speaking, the team, no matter who we're talking about Duke, Boston College, or Purdue, Michigan, you know, like the team that shoots it better, it significantly above its average and the other team way below, you're going to, you know, what the result is. So that's one reason not to make too big of a deal of it, I guess. But, you know, I don't know. Hey, it's so funny riding the wave of college basketball this season. It can be so easy to do because the highs are very high. Mm-hmm. What fan of a team you are, like most teams have really showcased their potential in a dramatic sort of emphatic way. in college basketball this year. But then they've hit, a lot of teams have hit rock bottom, and not to say that this was necessarily a rock bottom moment, but it was certainly
a bad second half. It was a really bad second half, you know.
That's about as bad as poor as Creighton's played in for 20 minutes as it, like, since San Diego State, basically. Yep. So, like, to see those two games back to back, it does, like, it's hard to kind of make sense of all that. But, you know, generally speaking, going into it, I was curious to see how the Jays would respond, not just to, like, the praise and the feel, like, the good feelings, the good vibes that you get from beating a team like Villanova and the confidence that you have, but how will you respond at Providence, which already is a tough place to play. Stylistically, it's tough for the Jays, but also you know that the Friars – needed that one. Creighton went on a road trip, a two-game road trip, and I think if those guys were honest, they would feel good about going home 1-1. They wanted to go 2-0, but if you went home 1-1, you feel pretty good. So you win that first game, suddenly you go to Providence and you're thinking, okay, we're playing with house money, whereas Providence is playing for its life. Like, it has to win that game, given what's ahead of it and what it did in the past in terms of making the NCAA tournament, its resume, you know, the stains that it put on it. So that's what I was curious about. And if Creighton would have been able to rise to the occasion and get a win, I think it would have said a lot. So instead, it kind of just, I think maybe it's a little bit of a reality check for those of us who follow the Jays, but I think it can't be too much of a surprise to see an L at Providence after the Jays are coming off a big win at Nova.
Yeah, I mean, the Vegas favored Providence for the game. Just, you know, just food for thought for you. I mean, Providence was favored. I mean, and it's easy to say, it's ad fact. Like, I thought, like, you know, when you're kind of doing the, you get the schedule out and you're like, okay, that's a win, that's a loss, that's a win. Like, I had this as a loss. Like, I thought they were going to lose this game. And what's for as much as you want to throw stones at Providence, I mean, Providence probably should have won the game in Omaha. You know, I mean, it took like a miraculous flurry from Creighton to find a way to win the game at home. And I just think, you know, with the way Creighton is built, and I know this sounds crazy, and you might go, okay, Nick, give me a break. Like, are you drinking on this Thursday night? But like, I'm not so sure that I would, if I'm Creighton, I'm not so sure that I wouldn't feel more comfortable playing Villanova in Madison Square Garden than I would Providence, just because of the matchup. And I know that, again, you're like, what? I mean, come on. Villanova is a top 20 team. Like, you got to be kidding me. But I'm just, I think with the way Creighton is built, Providence is a hard team for Creighton to beat.
Yeah, and I mean, the way that they can really get on the defend. Man, I thought last night, like, Malik White, David Duke's always a really good defender, but I thought Malik White was really good. I thought Reeves and Diallo were both good defensively. And on the glass, I thought Providence's bigs played pretty well. Like, just as a whole, as a team, I thought they did a good job taking away some of the things. They really pressed up on the Jays' guards. And I don't know if Villanova just has, like, the foot speed to do that. They have the length, but I don't know if they have, like, sure, they pressed out and tried to take away threes, but once Creighton gets its pace going and moves those guys around a little bit, it becomes harder for them to stick like glue the way that Providence's guys were. And I think they benefited from a whistle that was a tight, it wasn't a tight whistle.
Yeah.
You know, like, they were letting a lot of things go, a physical game where there weren't fouls called on either side, but I think that ended up favoring Providence. And then, it's interesting because I was thinking about it as I was rewatching the game. I'm like, you know, the way Creighton's constructed defensively, if a team shoots the ball well, because of the way, and you talked about this on your last podcast, because of the way that Creighton has to help defensively and kind of plug things up inside because of its size disadvantage, especially at the 4 and the 5, like, it's going to give up open jump shots. And a lot of times it's hoping to give up open jump shots to guys who aren't great shooters. And, you know, Providence has a couple guys who can get hot, and they showed that they did. They got hot in that game. But I think Creighton's just going to be in games a lot of times where it's going to have to hope that team isn't on.
Totally and correct.
That,
yep.
That that's worked for the most part all year. And it didn't work at Providence. Those guys, I mean, they shot 12 of 20 from three. It's their best shooting performance from distance all year, except for maybe like Sacred Heart, which is a season opener. So if they shoot their average, I think they would have made like 7 of 20. So that's a 15-point difference. Incredibly significant, obviously. So I think that's just kind of how it's going to be for Creighton defensively, is they're going to give up jumpers. And they have to hope that either they give up those jumpers to guys who can't shoot, or guys who just aren't hitting that day.
Yep.
And Providence, unfortunately for Creighton, was hitting.
Yep. That's, I mean, I think that's when, you know, when Paul Lusk and the staff are, you know, they're devising a game plan, you know, they're going into it obviously realizing they have a massive size deficiency, especially when they play small with Mahoney and Jefferson at the four and the five. And so they sit there and go, okay, we can't take away everything. What are we selling out to try to eliminate, and what are we living with? And, yep. You know, Creighton's a team that's going, all right, we're going to pick your two or three shooters that aren't great, and we're going to live with those guys taking shots. And if they make them, Creighton's in trouble. And if they don't, I mean, Creighton's in great shape. And in a lot of ways, their defensive game plans aren't too terribly different than Nebraska's right now. Like Fred Hoiberg's doing the same thing. They're just like, they're selling out to pack the paint. If a team's making threes, they're going to get rocked, you know? And if they're not, they can beat Purdue and Iowa. And, yeah. You know, the difference is obviously that Creighton's just a better overall team and offensive team than Nebraska, so they can, you know, even overcome more. But that's just when you are deficient in the post, you got to sell out to take away, you know, Nate Watson and those guys, and live with what happens from the three-point line to a certain extent.
Yeah, they gave up 18 points in the paint, which is a season low for Providence.
Yeah.
Like, that was the plan. That you're talking about, hey, you sell out and stop something. Like, Creighton, that's what they did. They stopped that. Unfortunately, they just gave up 12 threes.
Yeah, you know.
And that's not by design, but you kind of had to live with that. So I think that if they played Providence again, they'd say, we're going to do what we just did again and hope that AJ Reeves doesn't go 6 for 8 and Alpha Diallo doesn't bang in a corner three when the momentum's tilting Providence's way and David Duke doesn't hit like a step back three at the end of the shot clock. Like, I think they that's just kind of the way that they're going to have to go. And obviously on the other end, offensively, they have to find a way to not score 20 points and a half. but you know, they, after the game, they kind of talked about how they liked a lot of the shots they got against the zone. They just didn't hit them. So yeah, I think in a game like that, when a team is hitting, then it does put a lot of pressure on their offense, and maybe that pressure, they felt it as the momentum started to shift, and then maybe they started to press a little bit offensively. But it, yeah, like when the team's hitting and Creighton's going to give up jump shots, then they got to score with them, and they weren't able to do that against Providence.
And I think there's a, you know, there's a when Providence went to the zone in the second half, I've always felt like teams that aren't zone teams, you know, like Jim Boeheim or whatever, where it's like, this is, you know, what they do is play zone. I always think if you can bang a three or get a lob dunk right away, you can spook them out of the zone. You know, they're gonna be like, ah, forget this. No, let's go back man to man. And Creighton wasn't able to bang shots right away. And then all of a sudden, then zone gets into your head. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. Then you really get on your heels. Now all of a sudden, you're second guessing things. You're not aggressive. And I mean, I've said it all, like, I think one of the things about Creighton, I think zone bothers Creighton. Oddly, I know it's weird where you go, okay, Creighton's a great three-point shooting team. Zoning them is probably not a great idea, but I don't know. I've always felt like zone bothers Creighton.
I thought 2 years ago that Creighton team was really good against the zone. It was the team with Marcus Foster and Kyrie Thomas.
Yeah.
Marcus's senior year, Kyrie's junior year, because both of those guys are big-time playmakers that can get in the part of a defense, and they're good passers. Like, they both average like 3 assists a game or something. And so, and they had Martin to put pressure on the rim. I thought that team was pretty good at attacking the zone, but since I've been covering the team, this is my fourth year now. Yeah. There have been moments when they just kind of get in funks and they haven't been able to like sort through it. And I think it, like you said, it kind of gets in their head a little bit. And I thought, you know, they definitely made some adjustments. They tried different guys in the middle of it. I thought they did a pretty good job of getting the ball, moving it quickly and getting it to the rim. But then they got shots blocked, or they just missed shots at the rim. And it just kind of seemed to snowball in a negative way. You know, those threes weren't falling early, and then they tried to go inside, and then they kind of finished, and then it was like, oh no, we're down 10. And then it got worse. I don't know. I think this team, I mean, the stats would tell you that they were okay against the zone. They just hadn't seen a team normally kind of what you said. I think a team, the opponents haven't stuck with it for that as long of a period of time as Providence does, because I thought Providence was going to get out of it as soon as, like, I think Tyson hit a three at the top of the key.
Yeah.
And I was like, that might be enough.
Yeah. They're like, screw this. Let's go back man to man. Yeah. Right.
And then there's another good one that finally goes in. It's like the floodgates might open, but Providence, to its credit, stuck with it, and Creighton couldn't make them pay. So most teams, I feel like this year, have shown it, and then as soon as they've given up a couple of threes, like this is that. That's how it was with Providence in the first game.
Mm-hmm.
Like Providence showed it a couple times, but didn't stick with it. And I think that there's just some concern about what do you do when you give a Mitch Balick or Marcus Zagorowski an open shot repeatedly. That's kind of scary.
Yeah,
so
terrifying.
We'll see. Yeah, we'll see if more teams try it.
Right.
Down the road against them, because that length is that not every team has Providence's length, but it definitely bothered Creighton last night.
So Denzel Mahoney, I mean, obviously he struggled. He had probably his worst game as a Blue Jay last night against Providence. But up until last night, he had really started to settle in and was averaging about 15 points per game over his last six games until the Providence game, was shooting efficiently. From what did you think? Take me into your mind as you've watched Denzel get integrated. Like, what has allowed him to start to fit in and flourish? Like, is what to you has stood out? Because I think Travis Steele called him a game changer, and I'd agree.
Yeah, I thought I just thought it was like a flow and timing thing. When I talked to him a little bit, he was talking about like getting his rhythm. Two plays stuck out to me early in Big East play. He drove left, because he's a right-handed driver, so he drove left against Butler late in the game. I think they were down four and got a shot blocked. And then against Villanova, I think it was an ISO play. He drove left.
On the baseline out of bounds late.
Yeah, got a shot blocked.
Yep.
And then, I don't remember. I mean, he got blocked last night, but there was that – when you talk about that stretch where he looked like he settled, it just looked like he had a better feel of where guys were going to be. There's a play another left-handed drive against Xavier where he beat Tyreek Jones off the dribble.
Yeah.
And he kind of just like, he had a good feel of where Tyreek was, and he kind of waited for him, got the body contact and won. And so that to me was just, I mean, maybe it was just an adjustment of like better players, length, you know, again, just kind of getting used to playing ball again. So I thought he was just, had a better like feel for the game, and then, you know, he's sharing it a little bit more and knowing which shot to turn down and when to fire it up. And I think he's just more confident too that he started to hit threes, because he was a 40% shooter from 3-point range at SEMO, and then you start his Creighton career like, I don't know what it was, 5 of 20,
yeah, something like 5 of 24 or something.
You know, yeah, not good. But he started to see that ball go in, and I think that helped him too. So yeah, I feel like his, where he helps Creighton is it gives them sort of an advantage having another weapon at the four. Him and Damian Jefferson can hurt teams there, especially when they're putting so much emphasis on stopping Creighton's guards. But it gives Creighton sort of another option if the bigs just don't have it working, or if they're in foul trouble or banged up, because without him previously, if Christian Bishop got in foul trouble or when Kelvin Jones was out, like Damian Jefferson was playing the five, and that wasn't a great option, you know, and then suddenly you're going deep into the bench in your backcourt. So I think this allows Creighton a little bit more lineup versatility, and maybe it's working with five guards and you can put teams in binds. That's what they did against Xavier, and I thought they did it against Nova too, for stretches. So in the long term, you know, he didn't play, like you said, he didn't score against Providence. That was his worst game. But over the long haul, obviously he's making a huge impact for the Jays and gives them a better chance of kind of reaching their peak at the end of the year where they want to be.
Three questions, and then I'm letting you run and go be a dad. Okay. Marcus Zagorowski, you know, the reality is he kind of set an unrealistic bar for how he was scoring and playing in the non-con. Like, I mean, I don't know if anyone, if you thought he was going to continue to, you know, shoot 55% from the floor and score 30 against Butler, like, I mean, come on. That's just like, that's really hard to do. I thought he did a better job of like creating space and hitting his little mid-range stuff against Nova, but obviously he struggled against Providence. And, you know, he's slowed down a little bit. I think there are obvious things to point to of he's getting a lot of the you know, the other team's emphasis in terms of their defensive game plans and all that. But what are you seeing from Zegarowski? Because I've been on the right. I just think like he is Creighton's going to go. If Creighton goes to the Sweet 16, he played great. Like he, if he has to play well for Creighton to really pop, and I don't think it's a huge dot to connect that Zegarowski goes, I think it went 1-for-10 or whatever it was against Providence, and Creighton really struggled.
Yeah. I feel like he's not getting as many in rhythm three looks as I remember him getting earlier in the year, just like catch and shoots. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That may just be total anecdotal, but that's just one thing that popped into mind. I feel like he's being forced to kind of just be the creator, and instead of like, whereas I feel like he was a creator at times in the non-conference too, but now the book's out on him a little bit and they kind of know his moves. I remember the first Nova game, I could hear the players talking on the court about, you know, keeping him off his right hand. And even if he goes left, watch him cross back right. And mm-hmm. Sadiq Bey was sitting on it a couple times. And so I think that they know some of his go-to moves. That's one thing. I feel like where his game had elevated and what was really impressive to me in non-con was that he was finding ways to score inside the arc, yeah. Whether it was like 8-10, the mid-range J, driving and getting to the rim. And those have either, because teams have, you know, stopped his drive, because they've worn him down a little bit by attacking him defensively, maybe it's just he's not getting as many calls, or they could be a little bit more physical with him. They put longer, better defenders on him than he saw in the non-conference because of kind of what you said, how important he is to Creighton. So I think there's a lot of factors, but knowing the player that Marcus is, like, I think he's just, you know, he's taking all this in, yeah. and trying his best to, I would expect that you'll see him sort of, okay, I'm learning right now and it's frustrating, but I think that you'll see him take a jump. And you're seeing it a little bit, like, I think he's being more of a distributor lately. Like, he's recognizing how teams are kind of swarming to him. Like, he had 7 assists against Providence, and I feel like he had a couple other plays where he set guys up just from, you know, his ability mm-hmm. to kind of manipulate the defense. So I think he's going to take a jump, and you'll see the scoring number go back up at some point here down the stretch. But, it's definitely dipped, but he might be number one on the priority list for teams defensively. Yes, right. I mean, that's basically what it seems like with who they put on him. So he's drawing a lot of attention and I think he will adjust.
You can tell when any opposing coach that's getting ready to play Creighton, like the first name is Zegarowski. They're like, man, yeah. This dude is, I mean, I don't think he's getting as much in transition. And I think that he would get a bunch of, I bet if you went back and ran the numbers in the non-con, he was getting 6 to 10 points, just like, you know, push it, lay up, push it, mid-range, push it, three. Like,
yeah.
And he's not getting as many of those because that's conference play. Teams are more dialed in to the pace and what they need to do to slow Creighton down in the open floor. And so I think that's kind of hurt him a little bit. And that's one thing that will be nice when Creighton does, obviously, you know, draw a team in the NCAA tournament. Like, these teams aren't used to the pace, and I actually think I think when Zegarowski gets a crack at a team that isn't dialed in on him like that with the pace, I think then you might see the scoring kind of creep back up for him. But I'm not worried about
that's
it.
That's a good point.
Okay, so here we are. Gosh, we're about like halfway through the Big East slate. How do you size up the Big East now, and how does Creighton kind of fit into that? Having seen almost every team.
Yeah, I don't know. Why am I a Seton Hall hater? I'm a Seton Hall hater for some reason. I don't know
really?
Why.
Okay, give it to me. I'll see if I can, because I think they're pretty darn good.
Every time I watch them play, I'm like, dang, man. Like, and we talked about this briefly last time we chatted on the podcast. Like, Quincy McKnight is distributing like crazy, whether he's running those ball screens or setting things up for shooters. And Miles Powell, like, I don't know why it is, but every time I like someone asks me about the Big East, I'm like, well, we'll see what Seton Hall does. They haven't played Creighton yet or Nova yet. And I don't know why, but they seem to be, every time I turn them on again, they impress me. So maybe I should, I think it was probably because I was skeptical at the start of the year and I haven't been able to shake that like preseason mentality that I like put in my head for whatever reason. But they got the lead. They got the cushion.
They do.
So everyone's going to be gunning for Seton Hall. Obviously, you got to play Nova at Nova. That's like a must-win game for Villanova. Well, having lost two in a row. But it kind of feels like it's Nova and Seton Hall and then a gap. And then the rest of the teams, I think Creighton, based on what I've seen, may have the edge on that next group of teams, Creighton, Providence, Marquette, Butler. But with the Jays, kind of what we've talked about, like they do have such a small margin for error that they have to play well, especially the three guards have to be really good and locked in. Otherwise, they can get beat by pretty much anybody. So, I think Creighton's in a good spot. Honestly, they're better positioned for not just an NCAA tournament berth, but the finishing the standings, better position than I thought they would be going into the year. I did pick them fourth, I think, but to be 6-4 with what I think was the tougher part of their schedule. I mean, they got some good teams coming up, but 5-8 at home, and Creighton obviously plays really well at home, and they can get his pace going and shoots it better. So I think they have a chance to really finish strong, like a 6-2, I mean, maybe 5-3, 6-2. There's an opportunity to do that. And so, to me, that would be a good year. I know the players were talking a little bit last week about, aiming for a Big East title. Then they beat Nova and you're thinking, okay, yeah, they got a shot to do that. And so if they fall short, you may think, well, it's a little disappointing, but I think if they were to finish 11-7, 12-6 in a league that's the second best league in the country this year. That's, you got to feel pretty good about, not only your season, but your potential in the postseason, what you can do, having managed that gauntlet and navigated your way through it. So, I've been impressed so far, honestly, on the grand scheme of things, I've been impressed with what they've accomplished. So we'll see how they finish. Cause obviously everything ratchets up a little bit in February. It's going to be an important month for the Jays.
You know, it's so interesting that like Creighton's done with Providence, haven't played them twice. They're done with Xavier. And yet they haven't seen St. John's. They haven't seen Seton Hall. Like, it's just weird how their schedule falls. Last thing I'll let you run. How do you think Creighton will handle St. John's press? Because they really haven't gotten pressed at all this year.
I know.
It'd be interesting.
I would think okay.
I would think so, too, but on paper. You go, God, they play like five guards, you would think. Like, but, man, I don't know. You never know until Figueroa and Heron and those guys are heating you up. You kind of just don't know.
Yeah. I like that. There's one kid they have on it. I think it's Rutherford.
Rutherford can lock you. Yeah, he's a...
He's so deceptive with you. Is he coming? Is he bringing that pressure? Is he coming with the trap? Maybe he's backing off me. Oh no, all of a sudden he stole the ball from me. So I think him and Figueroa could, I mean, I would imagine they're just going to try to hound Creighton like crazy. Marcus Zagorowski and Tyshawn. I don't know. I would think they'd be okay though. They haven't seen this type of press before, but they've definitely worked at it in practice. I've seen them work against the press at times this year. These guys have experience, Balik and Alexander, Damian Jeff, like they've played basketball before, like a lot at this level. So they're a good team in terms of not turning the ball over a lot. They've been that way. So I think that they should be able to not just break it, but exploit it.
Yeah,
I mean, you look at St. John's numbers. Yeah, they get a lot of steals, but they also give a lot. They give up a lot of assists, which to me says teams, when they break that press, there's a lot of options open. And
no
so
doubt.
That's what I would imagine Creighton. That's what they'll look to do, and I think they'll be okay doing that.
It'll be interesting. I'm really excited for this game. Like, it'll be interesting to see, you know, I mean, first of all, if like St. John's has the guts to like come into Omaha and like press these dudes for 40 minutes. You know what I mean? Like they're going to,
I guess what I was curious is how like strong are they pressing? Like, are they just doing the one-on-one man-to-man look, or are they really coming with that trap? And how, you know, they, it's probably hard to bring that trap every time because you just don't have as much energy. But like, if it's like that Memphis, remember when Memphis catches up that press in the NIT?
Right.
I was like, for about 5 minutes of that game, I was like, oh my God.
It was a complete meltdown. And it was like, it was unbelievable. It was 5 or 6 minutes of like, oh my gosh, this is like, everybody cover their eyes. This is not good.
So if St. John's were to bust that out at the start of the game and suddenly it's like 20-6,
right,
then okay, that might be something. But luckily for Creighton and against Memphis, that the Jays had a decent enough cushion to where they blew the lead, but eventually Memphis ran out of gas and Creighton could close it out. So I'm kind of curious to see how much can they press and bring sort of that tenacity and keep it at that high level for 40 minutes on the road against a team that doesn't mind playing up and down and pushing pace.
I always think the big thing when you're playing a pressing team is to keep them off the free throw line, because free throws are when they can set their press. And then just, I know this is like, you know, you try to get stops against every team, but like, if they're not scoring, they can't set their press. You know what I mean? Like, if you're getting stops, it's hard to press off of a missed shot. You know what I mean? So, like, I just think stringing the ability for Creighton to string together stops, almost go, if you want to go get some kills, just steal the Xavier analytical thing that they do. But keeping off free throw line and stringing together stops, I think if they do that, then a press is kind of hard to sink its teeth into you. You know?
Yeah, that's a good point, because I've noticed is when they can set it. It does become.
It's way better.
Yeah.
It's way big difference better. In it. Totally. He's John Niatawa, Omaha World Herald. You got multiple podcasts going. What's the one with you and DeMarinis called after the games? It's fantastic. I'm blanking.
Yeah. So we do the Blue Jay Beat.
The Blue Jay Beat.
You know, I think that's what we call it. It's actually Matt's pod.
Right.
I just hop on it every now and then after games. So he deserves the credit. I'm like a stand in. So I do that, and then the half court press with Chris Hetty through the World Herald. So I talk a lot about hoops, which is a good thing for me.
It's a great thing. It's a great thing. I love it. Make sure everybody go check out John's stuff, omaha.com. I kept you way longer than I said I would. I apologize. Go be a dad, okay, John? Go be a dad.
Locking in right now.
I love it. Thanks, John.
Production.